abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
And welcome, everybody, on this Tuesday, October 29th, 2013. Tom Woods here, and as promised, we'll be joined in a few minutes by Dr. Ron Paul himself, and I will be asking him a good many questions that were submitted by you, the listener. Now, if you're a listener, you may be thinking, hey, Woods, wait a minute, I'm a listener. How come I didn't get a chance to submit a question? Well, as always, I solicit the questions using social media. So if you want to follow me on Twitter and be able to ask questions of the guests that way, please do so by following me at Thomas E. Woods. And from time to time, you'll see me tweet something like, hey, I'm going to be talking to so-and-so on such-and-such date. What should I ask? Also, like my page on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook as Tom Woods, so don't look there. It's facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods, or just visit our show site, tomwoodsradio.com, and click like on the Facebook widget. We broadcast this program for the first time every day at tomwoodsradio.com at noon Eastern with a Facebook comment feature while the program is running, and then you can listen to the program at your leisure by using our archive or our RSS feed or by subscribing on iTunes, which is a super great thing to do, which we always appreciate around here. Okay, now let's turn to Dr. Paul himself. You all know who Ron Paul is, right? I don't need to list his credentials. If any of you have seen any of my videos defending him against his pygmy detractors, you already know the esteem I hold him in. You know his credentials. You know who he is. You know about all the great books he's written. He's had several New York Times bestsellers in a row. He had The Revolution, A Manifesto. He had End the Fed. He had Liberty Defined. And his latest book is called The School Revolution. So we'll talk to him a little bit about that and some other things that are on your mind. So right now, we're going to turn to Ron Paul. Dr. Paul, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
All right, let's start off with all the things you're up to. That'll probably take up the whole show if we're not careful. But last month, you had a new book come out called The School Revolution, which I think propels the Ron Paul revolution into the future. Why don't you take a minute or two to tell us what that book's about?
Everybody knows I've been interested in education for a long time, and leaving Congress, and I thought, well, what other thing could I get involved with? I've always worked with, as you have, with the Mises Institute, realizing, you know, the teaching of Austrian economics is the answer to refuting the Keynesians. But I've often dreamed over the years about having a school, you know, a brick and mortar type of school, you know, when I got out of Congress, but I never knew when that time would come. But as this approached that time, you know, talking with both you and, of course, Gary North, talked to me about this and explained to me what is available now with the Internet. So I'm interested in that. So that's why I got together and wrote the book, a little bit of history about homeschooling, a little bit of research on that and trying to get people energized. And lo and behold, it's at a time in our history where just about everybody's upset with the public schools. It's not just we who believe in a libertarian free market message and the freedom principles. Everybody I talk to in traveling around the country on the book, you know, no matter what persuasion they were, they couldn't brag on the government school system. So I think it's ripe for that. And I think the glaring failure of the system is so much that I think it's an open opportunity to offer up a couple suggestions that I've worked on.
Well, I was glad to have a chance to talk about this on your channel the other day. And, of course, you have a site, ronpaulcurriculum.com, and I've got a direct ronpaulhomeschool.com that takes people right to your explanation of what your homeschool curriculum is all about. I think that's very exciting, partly because I'm involved in making some of the courses, and it's absorbing pretty much all day, every day of my time, but I feel like it's the most important work I've ever done, and I'm really privileged to be part of it. But as long as I've mentioned the channel here, tell us about the Ron Paul channel, and do you have any plans to expand the programming, or what do you hope to do with it someday that you're not able to do with it right now?
Well, of course, expansion is the goal, but it's not immediate. What we want to do is improve it the best we can to find out what the people really like. We've made some changes already. We've shortened the format. We have found, which we sort of suspected, people don't want to sit down and have a continuous program, you know, for 30 or 40 or 50 minutes. They might click on and off, but we're working on trying to make shorter information segments so that people can click on. But later on, I think incorporating more people, you know, involved in the freedom movement. But it's been pretty amazing to me how much technology is involved. The people who wanted to put the money into all the equipment and take all the risk, they're actually from California. So they had to put a studio here in my hometown because I didn't want to move to California or Washington, D.C. or New York. But they have a studio in California, and connecting all those wires and then connecting to somebody like when I interviewed you the other day, it's not simple and it's costly. So we're making our best efforts. And matter of fact, I'm very pleased with it. On the communications, you know, we've interviewed Glenn Greenwald from Brazil. So things have been going real well in that sense. But we're looking forward to expanding it and having more people on it and more programming.
So that's RonPaulChannel.org. Now I want you to tell us about Ron Paul Institute, RonPaulChannel.com and RonPaulInstitute.org. What's the Ron Paul Institute?
Well, the Institute for Peace and Prosperity, I think that is the one. That's the one dealing with foreign policy. And Daniel McAdams, who worked with me in my congressional office for a good many years and did the foreign policy work, is now in charge of that in trying to keep the momentum going for the non-interventionist foreign policy, something that surely came up a lot, certainly did during the presidential campaigns. And I think we have some momentum there where people now are starting to realize that the interventionist foreign policy has failed. When I think of the successes, at least a token success, on holding off the bombing in Syria, as well as actually talking to somebody in Iran, this to me is pretty amazing. So that's what that website is all about, and it's more academically oriented. It's not it's not videos. There's a lot of articles that appear, but it's keeping up with what's going on in foreign policy and to continue to promote the ideas of non-intervention in foreign policy.
Well, I've talked to Daniel McAdams, and he's hoping at some point to be able to have a summer seminar for students to teach non-intervention. Now, of course, we have antiwar.com, but I wonder, I'm not aware of any public organization that's dedicated to the principle of foreign policy non-intervention. I mean, has there ever been one?
Not that I know of. There were always some that, you know, would pick up bits and pieces of it. You can even find Republicans before me that would pick up bits and pieces of it, but not as a philosophy in itself. I guess the last attempt at this was when the founders gave us some advice, you know, and the advice was better than what they did sometimes, and the Constitution would give us that type of foreign policy, but we never really followed it. But where we really strayed was in this century, you know, with the Teddy Roosevelt Woodrow Wilson era, and it's gotten worse for 100 years. So that's why I think with the people in this country getting sick and tired of it, they're just so tired of the constant wars going on and the cost of these wars that they're worn out from it. And I think we live in a special age. I think economically we can talk about replacement of the Keynesian theories on economics and look more toward the Austrian school. But at the same time, I think on foreign policy, there's such evidence that this has failed. I mean, our Middle East, all this war going on for the past 20 years that we've been involved over there, such complete failure. And of course, the authoritarian, the real thugs of the 20th century, when you look at the Chinese communist government, as well as the Soviet Union, as well as Hitler Nazism, all failures. So, and I've been encouraged by this one, this policy to stick to a concise, clear policy. It's well received on our college campuses, and that to me gives me encouragement that the next generation is very open to having significant changes in our policies.
All right, now I want to shift gears and ask you some things that people have been wanting to ask, and it's not going to be the same old, why did you decide to get into politics, or what was the first book you read? I'm not going to ask you that. I want to ask you some unique sort of questions. And the first one comes from me directly. This is sort of a softball, but I am genuinely curious. In 2007, what event, or what was it that occurred where you first said to yourself, something unusual is happening in this campaign, that this is going to be bigger than I ever dreamed it would be? Was there one particular moment? Was it that you were winning all the post-debate polls all of a sudden? Like, what was it that made you say, whoa, something crazy's going on here?
Well, I can't remember the date, but I do remember an incident that I knew something was different. And it was very early in the campaign. There were so many debates. I think there were like 26 debates. And I can't remember whether this was the one that where I had the confrontation with Giuliani. But anyway, we had one debate, and I didn't think too much of the debate. But two or three days later, we were to have a small meeting get together of people on my list and expecting 100 or 200 people in Austin. And all of a sudden, when I arrived there, it was the first big rally. Probably was very small compared to what happened, you know, after several years. But then I thought, where did these people come? We've never had just a turnout like this. And somebody that I was saying that to myself or out loud, somebody said, well, it might have had to do with the debates that happened, you know, a couple of days ago. But I knew then that there was a significant difference in turnouts and enthusiasm. And it seemed like it kept growing, but it always sort of baffled me because, you know, I had been saying those things for so long and always to small crowds, and I had been saying it in Washington for 30 years. So it was pretty remarkable and so different for me to all of a sudden, hey, somebody all of a sudden, you know, paid attention and listened and they like it. So there was a difference, but a lot of factors were involved in it all coming together like that.
All right. So the questions are going to go in increasing difficulty. So the next one that somebody asked is, if you had it to do all over again, like your whole public career, is there anything you'd do differently? Like, well, you would presumably run for Congress again and you would do that, but is there anything that maybe you wouldn't have done or you'd have done differently?
No, and when I ran for Congress, it wasn't to run for Congress. It was just me getting stuff off my chest and speaking out. And politics is a bunch of luck and timing, and you know, you couldn't plan it to happen, especially if somebody's not enthusiastic about it. So I think the thing that I've looked at, although politically it didn't hurt me, I think long term it helped me, and that was running in the Libertarian Party in '88. It wasn't that that I'm less excited about the Libertarian Party. I always knew their shortcomings, but it was a struggle. It cost, you know, the money all went into looking to get on ballots, and it was such a hectic battle. But you know, the upside of that came about years later when probably I bet you 6, 8, maybe more individuals who came across what we were doing in 1988 ended up working for me, either in another campaign or in my congressional office. I mean, they were individuals. So a message was getting out, but it was so much smaller. But I never felt excited that by the end of that year and say, hey, you know, this was a great year. We're on the verge of saving the world. It was pretty tiring And it was a lesson on the lack of the democratic process. And I say, use that word cautiously. The democratic process here stinks when you think that we send kids off to die to spread democracy in the Middle East, because you couldn't get in the debates, you couldn't get on the ballots, and it's such a rotten system, especially if anybody comes to the conclusion that Republicans and Democrats aren't very different, which I think a lot of Americans agree with now.
Well, that actually raises probably the most common question that I'm getting, and I'm just going to pass it on without editorial comment. The most common question is, what made you decide to endorse Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia?
Well, you know, I picked the best candidate. I didn't feel like, you know, he was the pure person. There's a libertarian in the race, but there was a major article today about how weak the libertarian candidate is in Virginia. So I've never approached, you know, campaigning and tactics and talking to him, building up coalitions and trying to get support from this group versus the other group. I always thought that there was a little bit of room for negotiation there. But when it came to issues and a position, an endorsement of a position or a vote in the Congress, that's when I felt that there was to be no yielding to that. But over the years, I have worked with, you know, different people. And the danger there, of course, is, well, are you just picking the lesser of two evils? And that is a danger. Right now, and I worried about that a whole lot because there was a libertarian candidate in the race. It turns out that and I got the advice from people who worked with me for a lot of years from Virginia. And even though they were hardcore libertarians, they were not supporting him and were gung-ho over Kent.
You know, there's a guy in North Carolina, Dr. Greg Brannon, who's running for U.S. Senate there, has your son's endorsement. He is a pure Misesian Jeffersonian. I mean, I grilled him on as many questions as I could. And also, he's delivered 9,000 babies, which just blew me away. He's like, what, two or three Ron Pauls? How can that be? So anyway, he's a guy.
He either was a lot busier or he's delivered babies for more years.
Yeah, he was extreme. Yeah, he said that on his first day, he was involved in 24 deliveries. Like, welcome to the profession.
All right. Boy, that's a busy day.
All right, let me ask you another one that comes up a lot. I know you have answered this one in the past, but people want to know, you know, you were close friends with Murray Rothbard. You traveled in his circles. You sound a lot like some of the things he's saying. So people want to know, in your heart of hearts, are you what's called an anarcho-capitalist? In theory, would you favor no state whatsoever and the private sector provides everything? Or are you a minimal government guy, as you have claimed to be?
Well, I haven't accepted the idea that tomorrow we can scratch it and have no government. But the one thing I think where my career was different than so many others, we have heard a lot of people give a good speech when they're running for office and say, you know, he really sounds good. It takes about a week or a month or a year, and he just joins the gang up in Washington. I would say from what I believed in the very first time I ran for Congress in 1974 compared to now, when I left Congress a year ago, I would say that I'm much closer to anarcho-capitalism than I was when I went. So I've always gone in that direction. But I haven't sorted all this out. I haven't been able to figure this out about competing police forces and somebody, but the answer to that often if you have a corrupt police force who's private, you're going to have some problems. The world's not made up of perfect people. But what happens when you have a gang at the federal level and you have 100,000 federal bureaucrats with guns? I mean, that is so bad,
right,
that we have to reject that. But I haven't gotten to the point where all problems can be solved without any government whatsoever. I think the competing police forces could become a problem.
So I suppose that over the course of your career, I think you're sort of suggesting that you've soured a bit on politics. So what happens when a young, impressionable kid comes to you, has read a lot of the books that you've recommended, is full of zeal and enthusiasm, says, Dr. Paul, I want to run for office someday. Do you, and suppose the kid even says, but first I'm going to establish my credentials. I'll have a good private sector job. I'll contribute to my community. And then my culminating act in my life is to run for the House of Representatives. What do you say to that person?
I say, don't make that your goal. And I get that all the time, young people, and they don't even talk about getting a good job and knowing how to make a living in bad times. They just say, I want to be in Congress. And I don't think that's a good goal at all. I think if that time will come, it's like I mentioned, there's a bit of luck in it. It costs a lot of money. And if that is the goal, it's too easy to, bend a little bit, and say, well, how am I going to do it? They want to be taught how to raise money and how to organize and what to do on the internet to organize the troops and that sort of thing. And I tell them that, just learn the message, understand what liberty is all about and how to express it and teach other people. And something will come up. If it comes up, fine. But you might support other candidates. You might not even like politics. You might just want to be a teacher. There's so many other options. But, if the time comes and you run, the only way it can be of any benefit whatsoever is to vote the right way and set a standard. But to get up there and say, well, now I've worked 12 years now and I'm in Congress, the first thing that happens is the speaker gets hold of you, especially if you're in the majority party, is, okay, what committee you want? Okay, this is what you have to do. And these are the kind of votes you have to cast. And then they own you. And that is what you have to avoid. And going the other way is pretty tough today. The events didn't come together in the 1970s, and I decided to do exactly what I did in 1970. I don't think there'd be one chance in 1,000 that I could get elected, under today's circumstances. So there should be a secondary goal, very secondary. If it comes, fine. Political action is okay, but there's a lot of downside to it.
All right, last question, and I'll let you run, but. A lot of people would say, look, there's only so much a president can do. And, the president can't overturn the welfare state or abolish the Fed or whatever. But there are some things a president could do, I think. And I'm curious to know, suppose Ron Paul's elected president, what's the first thing he does in office?
Well, where you have the most leeway is where you're the commander in chief. If there are events going on with the military, you're in charge. This is one thing that is very, very clear. So you're not to have micromanagement of the troops. I would think you could, close down all military prisons, close down Guantanamo, and bring the troops home. And then you would be impeached. that's the problem. And how long would it take if you're president and they pass all these kind of bills? Send them over and then you don't sign them, it'd be very, very tough, to get very far. But, it depends on the conditions right now. They're not holding against Obama for listening to the people and not dropping bombs on Syria. So I still think the consensus of the people, the understanding of the people, understanding why free markets are better and it's in their best interest. I imagine the most a libertarian president could do now is to try to explain to the people why it's in their interest to look for less government, because all you're going to see from now on is the failure of economic policies, the welfare state, the foreign policy, the attack on our privacy, and what's going on from NSA. So there's a lot of good things happening today, and the Congress eventually will reflect the people, but the people have to argue this case. But I just don't think that one individual can change the world, no matter whether they're a president or not. I imagine it'd be better to have a libertarian president head of the Fed quit printing the money. That might do more good.
Yeah, that's right. That would be a question. Just first, do no harm.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, Ron Paul, as I'm sitting here wrapping this up, thinking, well, what is your greatest legacy of all this? I mean, is it the throngs of kids? Is it the Ron Paul Institute? Is it your channel? I don't even know what it is, but just thanks for enduring all the slings and arrows and just telling them to go stick it and just sticking to your message. You have millions of people out there cheering for you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Well, wonderful to be able to chat with Ron Paul today. If you're interested in the Ron Paul Institute, ronpaulinstitute.org is the place to go. ronpaulchannel.com for what Ron Paul is doing during the week. And then, of course, for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, ronpaulhomeschool.com. And for those of you who are adults who are saying, wait a minute, why should the kids have all the fun learning real stuff? You know, I didn't get the education in history and economics and these other disciplines that I wish I had. Well, the adults can have some fun, too, at my own site, libertyclassroom.com, where the adults can get courses you can listen to in your car, and you can learn the history that they didn't teach you. You can learn the economics they didn't teach you from professors who are Ron Paul approved, and it's super cheap. You ain't going to see any deal like this anywhere. So that's libertyclassroom.com, and you can use coupon code SHOW in all caps to get a discount there. So that was the Ron Paul Show today, ladies and gentlemen. Yesterday we talked to Kane. The rest of this week, it's just totally crazy. We're going to be talking about the emerging police state in the U.S. We're going to be talking about all kinds of topics that you're just not going to get in the mainstream media, and you get it for free every day, Monday through Friday, here at TomWoodsRadio.com. Subscribe on iTunes. Keep on listening. Thanks, everybody. See you around.
The Tom Woods Show.